Welcome to this podcast of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at www.commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. You can also find Inforum on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club presented by Inforum, a division of the club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/Inforum. Before we get started, I'd like to mention that tonight's program has been underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. That was my required speech. Now is what I want to say, which is that if Eve Ensler were simply the playwright Eve Ensler, she would be a force with which to be reckoned. Her work has been performed worldwide, not only, of course, her best-known work, The Vagina Monologues, but The Good Body, Necessary Targets, and now her latest book, I'm an Emotional Creature. It is subtitled The Secret Life of Girls Around the World. It has just been published in America. It is doing a slow, strategic burn of theatrical presentation all around this great planet of ours, and will soon be coming to a theater near you. I've just finished reading it, and it is moving and inspiring and hilarious and searing and terrific. Meanwhile, if Eve Ensler were also simply the activist Eve Ensler, who has raised more than $70 million to fight violence against women worldwide, she'd also be a force. Yeah. She'd also be this incredible force with which to be reckoned. V-Day, her organization, has crossed geographical and ideological boundaries to bring concrete and helpful assistance to regions in need of it. But the thing is that Eve Ensler is actually both those things, and they are inseparable. She has never rested on her laurels of embodying provocative entertainment and being a philosophical firecracker. And she has a rare gift, I think, in this chaotic muddle of a world to keep her eye and her pen and her voice on the clear and obvious questions that we need to ask ourselves and our fellow citizens. So please welcome a personal hero of mine and a personal hero of yours, Eve Ensler. So, what's the big problem that we have here on this world, and how are we going to fix it?
I knew.
We're going to start small, and then we're going to expand from that.
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for those incredible words. I'm humbled and moved, and thank you. And I'm thrilled that everyone's here tonight. Thank you for coming. I love Daniel Handler, and you might think this is a rare and interesting combination, the two of us. But in fact, Daniel Handler is one of the first people who ever supported V-Day. It was an early V-man, has stepped up through the years. And I want to say heartily supported it. He and his wife, Lisa Brown, have been true. You know, I always believe you can tell people who they are by the money they put forward. That's just my, and seeing that I spend my life begging and fundraising, I think that's even more true. And I just want to honor Daniel for his extraordinary work, but also just for your being a V-man in this world and for you understanding women and girls and putting yourself forward, because it gave me great hope at the beginning of this movement that other men would come forward, and they have. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, dear. Gosh.
So the question, I'm ignoring it.
Say it again. Yeah, that was a very good evasion.
What is the question?
The old let's just honor Daniel Handler trick. I'm on to you. Well, you have always been forthright about the fact that the central problem that we face as a world is violence against women. And I think that perhaps not to the people in the audience tonight, but to many people that comes as a surprising statement. And I was wondering if you might reiterate that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking this V-Day, because this is the 12th V-Day, which was Sunday, and you know, just to see where the movements come and where we've gone. You know, I was in the bathroom and every woman there had been in the Vagina Monologues, you know, and I walk through airports and people don't say, I saw your play. They say, I was in your play. You know, I did the flood. Oh, hi. I was in the Coochie Snorcher. And I think, you know, the world has performed the play at this point. And that's amazing. That's just an amazing idea. But, you know, I was thinking on this V-Day, you know, I was at UC Irvine Sunday, and they had nearly 1,200 people at their V-Day, completely diverse, all ages, all ethnic groups. So many men were involved in the production, and there were two men who really inaugurated V-Day at the start of the movement there, and they were telling me that when it started, it was in this really tiny room. They couldn't get anyone to say vagina. They were like, they were scorned. They were like hiding. And now there are 1,200 people. And next year they were saying maybe the stadium, you know. And I was thinking what progress we've made and how far we've come. And then I was also thinking how many women are still being brutalized and beaten and raped and maimed and undone. And I think really for me what is beginning to happen, and I can just feel the inklings of it after 12 years, I had dreamed we would be done by now. I was overambitious. But what I think hasn't yet happened is that we haven't gotten the centrality of the issue. We don't understand as humankind yet why it's so significant to end violence against women and girls, why that's the center of everything. And I think part of that is when we do understand that, patriarchy will be deconstructed. Do you know, if violence is the method which keeps patriarchy in its place, which it is, then to unravel and deconstruct violence means you have to de-ravel and unravel and deconstruct patriarchy. And I think we're close to the beginning of the deconstruction. Do you know, we're on the verge. Because I think when the deconstruction comes, it's going to be like one of those things that just unravels very quickly. You're just going to go, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. But we have to just set that thing in motion, which we're in the process of setting in motion. And I think if I could say what we really need to do is we all need to be bolder about our determination to communicate why ending violence against women and girls is so important. Because from my point of view, if it's true, and I believe it's true, what the UN says, that 1 out of 3 women on the planet will be raped or beaten in her lifetime, and that's true everywhere. This morning on the radio, somebody called in and said that's only in communities with people of color. And I just started laughing, and I was like, really? Well, come with me on my travels, you know, and you can hear all the communities I go to on any given day, and you will see that violence against women and girls is rampant in every single community in the world. It does not care about color. It does not care about class. It does not care about language. It's just a general epidemic across the planet. And I think if we really look at the marginalization and the violation and the desecration of women, and you see that women are life itself, what we're talking about is a movement across the planet which is about the desecration of life itself, about the dishonoring of life itself, about the lack of cherishing and honoring of life itself. And I think if you look at the earth and what has been done to the earth, it's the same exact story. That which brings life and holds life has been destroyed and pillaged and used and not, you know, we don't think of the future and we don't think of the distance. And I think when we really communicate what violence does to one woman's life, like the story of a woman's life, the you know, I spent a lot of time in the Congo, and there, I would say that on the planet right now, it's the worst violence in the world, and it's kind of a place where the emergence of colonialism and racism and sexism and capitalism has come into this fiery cauldron, a nightmare cauldron, but really, what I have seen there is if you take one girl's life and you look at what the rape of an 8-year-old girl does to her entire future, her entire soul, her entire self, her entire understanding of her own destiny and of her own rights, it's so deep and it's so fraught and it's so complex. One life that's been violated. So then you think of 1 out of 3 women and girls on the planet, that many lives that are suffering and that many complicated depth stories that go, it's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. And if you then imagined that we had all these women and all these girls who were brought up free, could walk anywhere they wanted at any time, could wear what they wanted, could be who they wanted, could be their full sexual. Imagine the life force creativity that would bring into the world. We would be transformed. We would be transformed. It would be that simple. So I think part of it is we, as women and men who care, step back and say, well, it's not that important. There are other issues that are more important. Not true. There are no other issues as far as I'm concerned. When we understand the significance of women and girls and their place in the world and the importance of the balance of their place in the world will radically change. And we will have a potential for a future as humankind. So I think that's, I'm still singing the same old song, but I feel like the song is being heard now. And I think if you look at how many people are now suddenly caring about women and girls in different quarters, where whether it's the UN or the New York Times or in other places where we've been battering and battering for years, there are doors opening. And I think that is change.
And when you are traveling and visiting and listening to the people who are talking, how difficult for you is it to keep your optimism? Because I know when when I start to read about the Congo, for instance, it feels to me like an etch-a-sketch. I just want to start over with it. That the history of pain and suffering in that region is overwhelming, and I think that I can't imagine there's anyone in this room or in our listening audience who is unfamiliar with the feeling with your morning coffee of reading about something that's going on and thinking, I think I'll just go back to bed today, let alone move forward and try to solve any of these problems. Mm-hmm. And is that difficult for you? Is that a challenge for you?
You know, I was saying today, that's the most asked question in some ways. Like, how do you hear all the stories? Because, you know, one of the great privileges and honors of being an activist and doing this work is everywhere I go, it doesn't matter where I am, people come up to me and tell me their stories. And I can just sit down on an airplane, they go, Eve Ensler, okay. And they just start, you know, and I'm like, okay, let me get my pen out. And that's both extraordinary and overwhelming because the majority of people are not lining up to tell me the good news. You know, it's not like, let me tell you my fabulous sex life and the great orgasms I had today. That isn't what's happening. Most people are there to tell me something they've never told anyone before, and it's a horrific story. And it's, I think this is what I have to say. And I'm going to tell this little story when I was younger. I think we believe, all of us, that if we resist and deny and push things away, we're going to be spared. And that somehow they won't hurt us or invade us or overwhelm us. I think the opposite is actually true. I think that which we deny and oppress begins to consume our energy like a tumor. You know, it's unseen, but it just begins to take our time and our lives, and it takes all of us. And then suddenly we're tired and we're sick and we don't know why. I think when we face things directly and we hear them, often they provoke huge emotions. And, you know, I spend a great deal of my time crying, and crying is perfectly legitimate. And I am overwhelmed a lot, but so what? I mean, people say it's overwhelming. And I go, yeah, it's overwhelming to be alive. That's true. Being alive is overwhelming. So get used to it. Be overwhelmed. Be emotional. Be intense. Be alive. I mean, that's what this is. Who told us being alive was being okay? Who told us that? That's just some mythology that grew up in America, particularly. You know, people in other parts of the world really get that being overwhelmed is a daily state of existence. You know, for 90% of the world who live in dire poverty, who make a dollar a day, being overwhelmed is the state that people live in. And so that's number one. And number two, you know, when I was during the Reagan administration, and I hold him responsible for the downfall.
Why did you look at me when you said a Reagan administration?
No, I was looking for solidarity. No, but I hold him responsible
not
for it.
Not my idea, I'll just say.
No, it was, wasn't it? No, I hold him responsible for the downfall or the beginning of the downfall of America. But I remember in
by
the...
By him, you mean Reagan.
Yes,
right?
Reagan.
Okay.
Not you. No. But
yeah,
I remember...
I was just listening to Prince in my room.
All right, you needed to remind me of your age, didn't you? Okay. But that was around the time when they were saying that ketchup was a real food. Do you remember that? And that homeless people could live on ketchup, and there were many homeless people. And I remember, and that nuclear war was winnable, and all those wonderful things that were going on, and that all you should care about is yourself. And but I remember at that time in New York, there were many, many, many homeless people on the streets, and I was very active in the nuclear disarmament movement, and I would walk down the streets and I would pass homeless people all the time, and I would pretend they weren't there because I didn't know what to do. It would just, and I'd be like, "Oh, there's not a homeless person there. Oh, there's not a," and I was getting sicker and sicker. And then one day a friend of mine said to me, "I'm going to a homeless shelter to volunteer. Will you come?" And I was like, "No, I don't want to go to a homeless shelter," because I knew the minute I went, my whole life would change, because I'd be with homeless women and I would care. And she kept saying, "Please come, please come." So I went. And of course, I fell in love with homeless women and I started to work. And 9 years later, you know, but I stopped walking past homeless people on the street. And every single person became a real person to me. And I would stop and I would talk, or I would give money, or I would offer support. And suddenly my depression went away, because I felt connected and I wasn't in denial anymore. And it really taught me a lesson that if we move towards what we're afraid of, as opposed to in denying what we're afraid of, we get a lot of energy. So I spent a lot of time, you know, I come back from the Congo sometimes, and I'm there. I was there in a month in December, and there's incredible, horrible things happening in the Congo. Things that are so mind-blowing, there is no way to process them in this human shape thing that we're in. So sometimes when I come home, I literally get in bed and I cry for a week. That's what I do. But that doesn't mean I can't survive crying for a week. It just means when the tears are over, then I get up and I do something else. And I think if you engage with people in any real way and you feel people, sometimes you cry for them, and sometimes you're in joy for them, and sometimes you're in laughter with them. But that's part of what it means to be a human being. And I don't think people really want more than that. The women of Congo don't want us to fix them. They don't want us to save them. People just want you to see them and feel them and know them and be with them in the struggle of humanity. And I think all of us tell ourselves we have to do something, and so we don't do anything, as opposed to just opening our hearts and seeing what happens, you know, when we're engaged with people in whatever struggle or suffering they're in.
Amen. This new book, which I find endlessly fascinating to think about, I am an emotional creature, is about girls, about young women, and for the most part, the monologues and voices in the book are women who have not yet had a breakthrough moment in a homeless shelter in which they're thinking about that. And I was wondering if you might talk about that state of mind, because it's fascinating, I think, to think about a state of innocence and awareness and the cusp that everyone finds themselves on at one point or another in their youth.
Mm. Well, you know, I love girls. I just love everything about girls, and I love the girl in all of us. You know, I think all of us have girl cells, men and women. And I think, you know, I spoke at TED India about these girl cells because I was trying to be really smart like all the TED people, and I thought, okay, I'm going to do something about cells, you know, because there's so many scientists and astronomers and biochemists. So I said, I'll do a talk on the girl cell, and it was amazing to me how many men came up to me after to thank me. I mean, one Indian man came and said, "Thank you for honoring the girl in me. I'm a girl in me. I have a girl in me." And all these really beautiful men were coming up to me saying, you know, I always knew I had a girl in me, but no one's ever allowed the girl in me. And one man said to me that he has been telling his wife they have to have boys, but he was going home to make four girls, you know. And I thought, oh, God, his wife's going to be busy, you know. But I think what I am struck by often about girls is how everybody's taught not to be one, right? Boys are taught not to be, what's a boy? Not a girl. You know, how do you know you're a boy? You're not a girl. What's a girl? Don't be a girl. What's a woman? Not a girl. What's a man? Not a girl. What's a leader? Not a girl. So I started to think, that must be very powerful, girls, if everyone is being taught not to be one, you know? And I guess maybe I'm a person who really stopped when I was 15. Like, I think if you said, what age are you? I think I'm 15. And I look at myself and I still see myself as 15. Like, nothing has changed, even though people apparently think I'm older. But I think, what is it about that time that I want to be or feel? And I think part of it is that I was fully alive and intense. I was myself.
And where were you at 15?
You know, physically? Or
every way.
I was in New York, but I was living in a very difficult circumstance, you know, in a family that was very violent and fraught. And I was being told on a daily basis that I was too intense, too dramatic. They called me Sarah Bernhardt. I didn't even know who she was, but I knew I wanted to be her. And I was too alive. I was always two. You're two. And, you know, I think most girls are told that. Most girls are told you're being too emotional. Most boys, oh, forget boys. The minute you're born as a boy, you're said, done. No feelings, no crying, no not knowing, no outbursts, no revealing your vulnerability. But for girls, that happens a little later. You get to be emotional for a while, and then you begin to get shut down. And I think, for me at any rate, having spent the last 12 years traveling the world to probably 60 or 70 countries, living in very difficult circumstances and kind of the rape minds of the world, I just began to see all these different girls in various circumstances, whether it was in Beverly Hills where they were obsessed with, you know, becoming pencils and looking like pencils, or whether it was in, you know, Bulgaria where girls were held as sex slaves, or whether it was in Kenya where girls were fighting female genital mutilation, or whether it was in, you know, Westchester where girls wanted purple Uggs, and if they had that pair of purple Uggs, they would finally be somebody, or whether it was girls who allow boys to beat them up. It didn't matter. What became very clear is that across the planet, there is this mandate, this cultural, familiar, societal, religious mandate that says girls are here to please. Girls are here to please. That's the verb, to please. And, you know, you can look at a young girl in Palestine whose boyfriend died, and she's being told to kill herself and blow herself up to serve that culture, or an Israeli girl who's being told to join the army, or a girl who's being told, and it doesn't matter. It's the same story, which is, you have to stop being you in order to serve a particular mandate. And I think, for me at any rate, the hunger to change the verb is so great. Let's get rid of please altogether. Let's just put it on the shelf for the next 30 years. We can go back to it later. But I think the verb has to be to challenge, to dare, to resist, to create, to defy, to know, any other verb but please. And I think when that starts to happen, we will begin to really support girls, particularly being their authentic selves, having their voices, stepping into their fully embodied original selves. And they're fierce. They're just, girls are fierce when they're allowed to be that full original, you know, thing that girls are. We did this production of Emotional Creature in New York that Rosario Dawson directed, and we had all these girls from, you know, all over New York, and it was Upper East Side girls, it was girls from foster homes, it was girls from Hedrick Martin, it was just the whole range. These girls, after 2 weeks of very little rehearsal, they just took the stage. We were like, oh my God, you know, stand back. When girls get their power, stand back, because it's a new resource. It's like wind. Like, we haven't had wind, and we're going to have wind now, you know? And I think I have great hope that when girls are actualized, you know, and when the girl in boys is actualized, there will be, again, another kind of shift in all of this.
And, yeah. I knew it would be hard to get you to talk, but it. and the book begins with a letter from you to the emotional creatures that are in the play and are listening to it. And is that a shift for V-Day in a way with this new play to bring it to a new age or a younger age?
Definitely. I've been hearing from years from mothers, why don't you do this for girls? Why don't you do this for girls? And I can never do anything just to do it. I have to have the way in. But I'm very happy to say we have launched V Girls, and we have a new website, and it's really incredible. And I think what we hope will happen is this will launch the next wave of V-Day, which will be V-Girls. And we'll be starting supporting girls at younger ages to look at the issues that they're facing and the obstacles they're facing, whether it's female genital mutilation or sex trafficking or eating disorders or, you know, not being allowed to be gay or whatever it is that girls are up against, creating a website and creating world and creating a curriculum that supports girls really being able to tell the true stories of their lives. Because I think often we see girls being represented the way parents and adults want them to be represented. They don't want to tell the real stories of girls. But what was exciting about doing this piece was the girls telling me, oh, my God, I get to say this? And because this is like me. And I think that's one of the things I get excited about is when we break through those taboos and we break through those boundaries which have told us we can't really say what's going on, but we start saying what's going on. And things change.
And are most of these voices that are in the new work, are these voices that you've heard more recently, or are there voices that didn't kind of fit into the vagina monologues that have now gained more prominence in your head, or both, or neither?
I think most of the voices in most of the stories in I'm an Emotional Creature are I've been working on it for 5 years. So they are either stories I've read, you know, like the story of the Palestinian suicide bomber. I read the story of a girl who had the bomb strapped on her and she turned back and she got arrested because she didn't blow herself. And I thought, wow, you know, she was 17 and she was about to blow herself up. That's incredible. Or girls I've met who, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the Congo and met girls who have been held in captivity for 2 years or 4 years as sex trafficked girls. Or girls I imagine, or girls, or the Free Barbie piece is the story of a Chinese girl who works in a factory making Barbie's head. And I've been obsessed with Barbie my whole life because I just can't believe there's such a thing as Barbie. And that there's 1 billion Barbies in the world and that one Barbie is made every 3 seconds. I mean, isn't that amazing? Like, a Barbie was just made. A Barbie was just made. A Barbie, I mean, that's just incredible. One day I just sat in a chair doing that all day. A Barbie was just made. It's, wow. And then we wonder why we all hate our bodies. God, wonder.
Well, the sexless bump between the legs of a Barbie.
Yes, exactly. She has no genitals. And she has a body that somebody once told me that if it were actual body, she would not be able to stand because the proportions are so out of whack. And it was really interesting in this group in New York. We had all the girls tell their Barbie stories, and it was fantastic. One girl said, who was gay, she was like, oh, I used to cut off her head, and I would put Barbie's head on Ken, and it was fabulous, and it all worked out nicely. And then another girl was talking who was African-American. She was saying they say that, you know, black Barbie is black Barbie, but she's really white Barbie because she has a white nose on black Barbie. And it was totally confusing because they were telling you it was black, but you knew she wasn't black. And everybody just kind of went around and told these incredible stories. They're actually going to be on the internet because I made them write them down. But it was like, if you want to understand your life, tell the story of your Barbie, you know, and what you did to your Barbie or didn't do, you know. But I don't even remember what the question was. But
what was your Barbie's name?
I used to hurt my Barbie.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I would cut off her head and do mean things to her. And, you know.
A friend of mine figured out she was queer when she was young, and she put one Barbie on top of another, and she had her first orgasm at the sight of it.
Those were the kind of stories that were emerging.
And now whenever I'm in Toys R Us or something, I'm just like... Yeah. I always want to call my friend, I guess, what I'm doing. Yeah.
See, that gives a whole new spin to Barbie, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, the piece, Free Barbie...
Yes.
Was I was reading a lot of things about the factories and the conditions of workers who were making Barbies, and the conditions were horrific. So I just created this character, this girl who I love and who was making Barbie's head in this factory, and she started to send, she did something called Headsend, where she would send her thoughts into Barbie's head, you know, and she'd be like, Headsend! And she would send them into Barbie's head. And then she believed that that head, like her head would, because she made a lot of heads, that her thoughts would go to girls all around the world because she really knew what Barbie was thinking and no one else did. And And at the end of it, she just does this whole thing. Imagine if we freed all the Barbies, you know, and they went from makeover to takeover. Imagine if we freed Barbie, free Barbie. And I just love this idea of just a free Barbie movement because it's such a metaphor for everything. If you look at the fact that we are having essentially child laborers making Barbies in Taiwan and Japan and China who are starving to make Barbie and then export Barbie to the West where girls starve themselves to be like Barbie, you kind of understand the story of the world right now, right? I mean, there's the story. So I think we need to really look at Barbie as a metaphoric movement that we could begin to look at all the issues, you know, entailed in that journey, you know.
Now, you mention a lot that you gather material by reading articles in newspapers and things like that, and that obviously you are also can't sit on a plane without hearing a story.
Right.
I don't know whether to envy that or to be grateful that no one tells me their stories on a plane. But is what does one happen more than the other? I mean, is there do you read more or do you? I always assumed when I first heard your work that all the stories that you hold were stories that you'd heard firsthand. But I find it fascinating that you almost make no delineation between a story that you're hearing straight from someone and a story that you're reading. And is that does it just come through your pores in every possible media?
Or well, I think sometimes. I mean, I think with the vagina monologues, what it would be is I'd hear a thing, like a woman would say she had a flood. And that's all she would say. It wasn't like that woman told me that story. Nobody told me that story. She just said she had a flood and she was embarrassed. And I was like, flood. Oh, my God. What a great word. What a great idea. A flood. Flood. And that leads to something else. Do you know? Or like a line. Someone will say one thing. Like the way I Am an Emotional Creature happened was I was talking to a group of girls in Watts. And I always ask girls, do you like being a girl? And usually girls are like, I hate being a girl. It sucks. I get my period. My brother can do everything. I can't do anything. It's like, ugh. So we were having the usual discussion at this after-school program in Watts, and they were just going around, and this girl sat up, and she was like, I love being a girl. I'm an emotional creature. And I went, oh, my God. And I was like, there's the book. And that's really how it started. You know, it was just that one line of, oh, I'm an emotional creature. Okay. And she then went on. She was like, I love it. I wake up. I'm intense. I'm, you know. And I think it's like that. You know, sometimes it's a fuller story that I then take and embellish and add and develop and change and transform.
Well, I'd like to shift a little bit from the positive reaction that you have to your work and look a little bit at the negative reaction, because a fascinating thing, if say you are going to interview Eve Ensler on stage, is that you go and, you know, you do some Googling. And you should remember this if you ever interview Eve Ensler on stage.
I'm not going to Google.
She's real nice. But the phrase the vagina monologues is used by all sorts of heinous ideologies as shorthand for everything wrong with people they despise. Mm. And that was fascinating that you've recently been insulted by Glenn Beck. You'll always have that. They can't take
I
that
put it
you.
On my resume. Yeah.
I mean, forget the Guggenheim Fellowship. Seriously.
I know, exactly. Indication of
anybody
humanity.
Anybody can get that. But being insulted by Glenn Beck, that's only like a handful of righteous people. But it was interesting for me to think that that phrase for some people is shorthand for something they're really afraid of and something they're really against, and then to think that a new work where the phrase emotional creature may turn out to be another kind of shorthand for the right. And it seems to me you couldn't help but think about that when you're doing your work and the way it will be responded to, not just by the overwhelming positive reaction that's happened, but also an angry negative reaction.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think when I first started doing the vagina monologues, I was shocked at how much wrath there was against vaginas. And the idea of speaking vagina out loud. I really was shocked. Just I couldn't believe it. I mean, people who can say Scud missiles and plutonium and nuclear war and had no problems with that were utterly terrified and horrified by saying vagina. And I think, you know, there have been movements, you know, anti-vagina monologues movements created by people like, you know, Christina Hoff Sommers and other people, you know, trying to go onto college campuses and shut vagina monologues down. Obviously, there are Catholic universities that have, you know, banned vagina monologues from college campuses. But I will say, I really see this long, long table. You know, what I see is the vagina table. And everybody's invited. And eventually everyone's going to show up. It's just going to take time, you know. And when I started doing this, if you had told me that the UN would be inviting me on a regular basis to address the Security Council, I would have told you, you were out of your mind. They did not want vaginas. They did not want V in you, okay? They did not want that, okay? That was not happening. If you would, you know, told me at the beginning that V-Day would be taken seriously around the world, you know, it takes time for people to change. It takes time for people to open up their consciousness. We've all been conditioned. We've all been programmed, some of us more deeply than others, and some of us are more male-identified. And I don't really see people as my enemies. I don't see the world like that. I see it as a continuum of transformation. And some people have gotten here early, and some people are going to come later. You know, people who wouldn't do the vagina monologues when it started call me now to say, can I do it? And to me, of course you can do it. Now you're ready to do it. You know, it's like you've grown someplace. You've come someplace. I know there are going to be people who have problems with emotional creature. They're not going to like the idea that girls are talking about sexuality and condoms and blowjobs and homeroom. Or they're not going to like the idea that I'm saying that there's sex trafficking. Or, you know, because people don't, the truth is scary. It's much easier to live in this ideal world, you know, this fantasy world where abstinence is going to make everything better. The fact that pregnancy rates are out of control as a result of abstinence, okay, that's a problem. But I think the fact that people are scared to talk about sex, for example. Do you know, why are we scared of sex? What are we scared about? And the answer to that, to me, has to do with the oppression of women. When you make sex something that women have control over and women are educated about and women have, you know your vagina and you love your vagina and you have agency over your vagina and you know what your rights are and you know what gives you pleasure, you actually have power. When you are kept in the dark and you are, you know, disassociated from your vagina and disassociated from yourself, you don't have power. It's not complicated. And a lot of, unfortunately, right-wing ideology and is based on women being in a servile position. So I think we really have to look at why people are afraid of sex, why people are afraid to talk about vaginas, why. And I try to do that in the face of often sometimes really hostile attacks. But I don't take it very seriously anymore. You know, I try to focus. Dr. King always used to say, keep your eyes on the prize. Keep your eyes on the prize. And I think we can get very distracted worrying about what people think of us. You know, it's none of my business, really. I think you have to listen to your heart and listen to your deepest intentions and do your work. And there are going to be people who hate you for it and people who love you for it. But really, it's none of your business, none of it. What you have to do is your work. And it's taken me a long time to figure that out. Believe me, I spent a lot of time going, they don't like me. You know, why don't they like me? Well, they don't like you because you're pissing them off. That's why. So move along and get a grip, you know. And I want to say, as girls, we are brought up to be liked. That's what it's all about, to be liked. If you stand up for anything, if you are bold with anything, there are going to be lots of people who don't like you. So we all have to make a decision, and it's in the manifesto at the end of the book, whether you want to be admired or liked. It's a huge difference in what life you live and what life you choose to live. And in the end, I think, you know, we should encourage each other to be bold enough to be admired and stand up to really articulate whatever it is you believe in and whatever changes you need to see manifest, whatever people say about you.
And did you have a crystallizing moment learning that you'd rather be admired than liked?
I think there's been many of them. I'm trying to think of one in particular. I know what it was. It was a really interesting thing that happened in the New York Times. And you know, we all pretend we don't care about reviews and blah blah blah. And And I think you get more resilient to attacks the older you get. Not that you get a thicker skin, you just know that you have a bounce back period. But in one week in the New York Times, I was celebrated and demonized, literally within 24 hours. And it was one of those moments.
I remember that week.
Yes. And I realized at that moment, I have to get off that wheel. Like, if I stay on that wheel, then when it's good, it's good. When it's bad, but they're determining my reality. I have to be the person who determines my reality, whether people like me or not. And I have been very happy since then, in a way. Things have really begun to turn in my life, because what can you do? What can you do? You have no control over how people respond to you, you know?
Yeah, when I have friends who are writers, and so whenever anyone gets a bad review in the New York Times, I used to have kind of a standard email I would write where I would say, like, don't you worry, we're going to get a posse together and we're going to go over and explain to that person. And then it began, I had to send it like 5 times a week.
You know?
And I just thought, I just became exhausted from kind of holding my torch in the posse all the time that I was always going to have to take to the streets. And then I realized maybe I could let a little of that go.
How do you deal with it?
I have a strange kind of curve when someone doesn't like me, where I care a lot about it for about like 15 minutes, and then it crashes. Right. You know, I think like, how can I get them to? You know what? Screw them.
Right.
You know? I'm kind of, but I definitely have that moment, you know, where I'm like, what am I gonna do? And then I'm like, yeah. And I try to stay off the phone, because I'll call some friend and I'll be like, I don't know, yeah, I'm sure you read it. And of course, they never read it, because they have some life of their own. And so then I always have to say, like, don't pretend that I know you've read it. They have no idea what I'm talking about. And then I get real upset about it, and then they call me back, and I'm like, oh, that was a long time ago. You know, they're like, that was literally 20 minutes ago. So I just try to stay off the phone, is what I've learned. It's time for me to stop talking, and kind of time for Eve to stop talking, and time for you to come up to the microphone with your questions. And if you don't have any, I have a gazillion questions. So speak now. Take the power from me and go over to the microphone.
And I'm short. 85 years as a girl.
Yeah. Woo!
At 13, I had trouble. So I founded a rifle club. There's nothing like a rifle to be in charge. My question, and I can't see very well, but I see all ages, and mostly women. We never, ever talk about the period. We talk so much about menopause that I got sick of it. It bypassed me. But we never, and they still advertise those, la-di-da with flowers, that is, you know, it's good, it's bad. We don't talk about it. The girls don't talk about it. Because I used to be Brownie, Girl Scouts, I forget what all. They don't talk about it. That would be the ones that are now 50. Why have you run into this? Yes, in your vagina monologues, there's two. Is there?
Yes, there's a monologue about periods.
Yeah, they have two, and there's that great song, The Spot. But that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Was that a question?
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I actually think girls do talk about their periods a lot. That's been my experience. Maybe we need to talk about them more.
Or to her.
Or to her.
Yeah. Yes.
Hi, Eve. I'm doing a vida in Spanish in San Jose. Ooh. Among many, many women. Yesterday, on our day off, we went to promote a vida at a local radio station. And a fellow called telling us that we are a very bad influence to girls. So at first I was shocked, because I'm like, oh, I wouldn't do this, but I also have like the 15 minutes, and that case was 15 seconds, and then I'm like, oh, ignore him. Next call. So how will you face that resistance, especially coming from men? And I mean, at least the V-Day, it's, at least in San Jose, it's only the first time in Spanish. So how will you face that resistance?
Well, first of all, I just want to bless you for doing it in Spanish in San Jose. Power to you, really. And, you know, I think whenever it enters a new community, you know, people always say this to me about vagina monologues. So I think it's so funny. They go, you know, in our community, we don't talk about vaginas. And I think, do you think you're the first person who said that to me? You know, it's like, you know, in Paris, which was, the play's been running a long, long time now, 10 years, it was the last place to do it. It was the last place. People were so, they wanted to change the title in Paris, okay? But every single place I've ever been to, they just, you know, in our community, in our religion, in our culture, I go, there is no place when I arrive, they went, yippee, vaginas are here. No place, okay? On the planet. So part of it is that it takes time when you come to a new place for people to see what it's about, to understand what the play is. You know, I used to make a joke that people, women love the play who have seen it and men hate the play who haven't, you know, and to some degree that's kind of true because I think men don't come, they just make up these stories, you know, and that's not all men because a lot of men do come and they're incredibly supportive and have seen it 20 times and love it and bring their daughters and their families. But the men who don't like it get scared of it. And I think part of it is because it's new. You know, people don't talk about vaginas, right? It's a new thing in all different cultures. And like when it started in Mexico City, where it's also run 10 years, people were completely freaked out about it. Now it's like what people do all the time. They just go and see the vagina monologues. So part of it is not getting defensive and reactive and all. It's just to let people have their feelings and go, uh-huh, I understand that. And why don't you come see the show? Come see the show. Come see what it is, you know, as opposed to, you know, condemning people.
Yes.
Thank you. I worked at the Women's Building here in town for a couple of years, which is in the Mission and has been dedicated to working for women and girls' rights for over 30 years now. So props to people who are in the room. So we had a vagina, I think it was 6 feet neon, the light up one that I believe was donated. So when the neon vagina was on, it was like we were coming home every day into the office. Anyway, I did fundraising at Girl Ventures, whose mission is to empower adolescent girls to develop and express their strengths, which is a beautiful mission. And the funding climate right now is very harsh and not allowing that mission to fully thrive. So my question for you with V Girls is, how are you facing the funding climate right now, and how are you collaborating with other girl-serving organizations and experts in the field?
Well, it's a great question, and what I hope is that V-Girls will become what V-Day is. I mean, we're going to now, we did 14 pilot projects this year all around the world. It started in India, where people did readings of the play so we could try it out to see how it worked. Then there'll be a commercial production of it, which will then hopefully spawn a lot of money for V-Girls. And then what I hope is that it will do the same thing that the vagina monologues did, that girls can use the play to raise money in all the communities where they're struggling for funding so that they can fund the various organizations. Because the way V-Day works is that you do a production of the vagina monologues in your community, and whatever money you raise, you keep in your community. So we've probably supported 5,000 to 10,000 local beneficiaries over the, you know, and each year many, many groups benefit. And you can raise $100 or you can raise $100,000 depending on what. So our dream is that we will be supporting many, many local groups who work to support girls through the play in the same way we did with V-Day. And I just want to say to San Francisco, you know, I love San Francisco so much. And I used to make a joke and I would say, you know, there are vagina zones, there are vagina love fests, but then there's San Francisco, which is a vagina world fair zone, you know, and right. There were never shows like we did in San Francisco. The last show I performed with the vagina models in San Francisco, it was like there were vaginas on the ceiling. It was just And so I just want to take a moment to really appreciate San Francisco and the wisdom and the bravery and the outrage and the people here are so amazing. And sometimes when I get really depressed about the world, I think, but they're San Francisco, you know? So thank you. Thank you all for being such amazing people.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
I am a senior in high school. I'm in Petaluma, and I have recently started this community organization to fight sexual assault and abuse towards women. And I am intense, apparently.
Good.
I am told. I am intense. I am hard to handle, and I'm hard to deal with, and I'm intense. But then you run into problems, especially with the high school set, where, oh, wait, she's intense. We don't want to work with her. What advice can you give for young activists who are trying to bring this to 15, 16, 17-year-olds?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Well, first of all, I celebrate your intensity and deeply. You know, I'll share my experience because I don't like to give advice. Who am I to give advice to anybody? But I'll share my experience. When I was a young activist, I was intense and aggressive. Okay, there were two things together, and not a great combination. Okay, and I was really bitter, and I was really militant, and I was really angry, and this did not make me a lot of friends. Okay. I needed to be that until I didn't need to be that anymore because I was a survivor and I had a lot of rage and I needed to process it. But what I have learned is that we do make more friends with honey than we do with bitterness and rage. And that's not to say that I don't have my moments when I'm angry and intense like that. I think there's a difference between intensity and judgment and aggression. And it's taken me a long time to learn the difference. Do you know? And I think I was very judgmental when I was younger of everyone and everything. And people smell it, and they don't feel good about it. And I finally made a decision. I remember I was fighting on the streets, working for nuclear disarmament, and people were spitting on me and things like that. And I finally said, you have to make a decision in your life. I remember one day on the street corner, if you want to be right or if you want to win. Because really right now you're just about being right and you're losing. You know, so that's really the difference. And I think sometimes you have to be strategic. Sometimes you have to be clever and find ways to move into things where you're not going straight into people's faces, you know. But thank you. Do not lose your intensity.
So there's this great moment in I'm an Emotional Creature. It's the purple Ugg boot story. For those of you who haven't read it, there's this moment where the character that's telling the story is confronting the mean girls. And confronting is really the wrong word. She's completely coming unraveled, like involuntarily, in the cafeteria. I mean, it's pretty good. And she gets through it because she has this Wendy character who stood up to the mean girl set and stood in integrity and faced the precipice. And I was reading it just going, God, if I'd had a Wendy, how different would things be? Mm. And so what advice do you have? I'm surrounded by young girls. I have two daughters. What advice do you have for young girls to stand in integrity and find their voice and use their voice knowing it's a rough road? Mm. What do you say when there's no Wendy?
You know, it's such a good question. You know, I was a very unpopular girl. I was very unpopular, and they formed clubs against me and things like that. No, it was horrible. They had anti-Evie Ensler clubs, and it was awful.
I think Glenn Beck is still in there.
I think he started it because I wouldn't go steady with him, you know.
Who can blame you, really? Yeah.
But, you know, I had this friend once, this really great friend, and I was so desperate to be popular because I was so hated. And she came over to my locker one day. I'll never forget this. And Wendy Apple is definitely a tribute to her. And she said, you know, I'm not popular. And when you look at me, you're not going to see like someone who can get you going someplace. I'm not going to get you into any of the great clubs. But I like you. And I'd be your friend. And she was like a poor girl. She lived on the other side of town. And she became my friend. And I could cry sitting here talking about her. She was the best friend I ever had growing up. And you know what? It was her love of me, really, if I look back on all those years, that kept me alive. And so part of it is, how do you be that person to to other people? Wow. How do you be that person? You know?
Thank you. How can girls conquer discrimination? You know, maybe in a school or something where they're saying, if you say that, you're going to go to the principal's office. So,
what are you saying?
Oh, sorry. So, you know, how can girls conquer discrimination without being vivacious and mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, without going to the principal's office.
Well, give me an example.
Well, maybe someone's making fun of you and you got really, really angry and you started yelling at them and threatening them. You say, I'm going to kick you in the shins or something.
Right.
They send you to the principal. How can we...
Is that what you did?
No.
Oh, okay. It was just an example. You know, sometimes I think you have to scream at people. I mean, I think sometimes, I don't think you should kick the people in the shins, but I think sometimes you have to let people know that they're hurting your feelings, you know? And I think sometimes it's worth to go to the principal's office and to say, people are being mean to me. And maybe sometimes it's good to find some other people who can support you in saying something to that person, do you know? So that you can do a group thing where we all look at why is that person doing and saying what they're doing. But I think it's really important you have your voice and you find the way to have your voice and you get support for having your voice from your peers and from teachers and from the community. And you don't cut off that voice, you know? And I love that you're talking with a helmet on.
Can't be too careful. We have a very little amount of time left, so we're going to try to take as many questions
as we
can. Oh,
it's a hat. Now I see it's a hat. It's a really cute hat.
Yes.
So, Eve, I just want to say that I love hearing all of your little anecdotes about yourself, and I know that you're a great medium to tell all these amazing stories for other women, but are you going to come out with your biography anytime soon so I can really get all the juicy details?
No.
Oh, God. Okay.
Don't make me do that.
Later.
I'll be as brief as possible so we can get many more questions in, but I represent a group of women at USF that are here that is a Jesuit university that has been doing vagina monologues for the past 10 years.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we just celebrated our 10th, and there has been some discussion amongst some of the theater groups that vagina monologues is somewhat outdated. And they're going to get rid of vagina monologues over my dead body. And I figured if I said, well, I talked to Eve Ensler about it, and this is what she said. So I was thinking maybe I could get some ammunition.
I think you should just say whatever you think I would say, and it will be just about right. You know? Because you seem to know exactly what to say as far as that. First of all, the fact that you have done this at a Jesuit university for 10 years is amazing.
Yeah, it's
amazing.
Wonderful.
And
wonderful.
Just power to you. Power to you for standing up. Because that, it takes courage, you know. And, you know, I think you know what to say. You know, I'm surprised that people are still doing the vagina monologues. You can ask my team. Susan Swan is sitting here, the managing director of VIDE. Raise your hand so everyone sees you. She's been doing this for 12 years. She has been running this movement. It's just amazing. But every year I say to my team, are they going to stop doing it this year? And I'm amazed that it's still going. It is way beyond me. I don't understand it. But I think as long as you want to keep doing it and other people want to keep doing it, fight to do it. You know?
I will.
Yeah.
I will. As long as I'm alive, I will.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Eve. I'm part of USF, actually, so it's funny how we ended up. I was wondering about your you as a writer, if writing has always been your passion, has that been your method to express yourself, or it just kind of... suddenly came to you one particular event?
Or? It's a good question. You know, I grew up...
Was if writing has always been your primary method of expression. Yeah, maybe we can be a little more aggressive in our microphone use as well. I mean, if you want to.
I just want to listen to Daniel talk and be funny for the rest of the night. You know, for me, when I was younger, I grew up in a really violent family. And I was constantly in a state of trauma, to be perfectly honest. And you know, I think one of the reasons I'm so devoted to ending violence against women and girls is I see how long it took me to recover from violence. And I'm an upper middle class white girl. Do you know what I mean? And I had resources. But one of the ways, I think the only way I survived, to be perfectly honest with you, is that I created a persona in writing that was better and okay. You know, I had this way of creating something by writing. And I wrote all the time because it was the way I kept myself sane. So I never thought, oh, I'm going to be a writer. I just wrote the way some people eat. You know, I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. And I still write like that. You know, when I go to the Congo, I write. Because how do I process what I'm seeing or hearing when I, you know, I'm in Pakistan where I just was and I see the horrible checkpoints and block, you know, and the complete shutting down of society and what, you know, how do you process that? You write. I was just with this beautiful girl in the workshop in New York who did one of the monologues, and she was this fantastic girl. And in the middle of the rehearsal one day, she just whispered to me, you know what happened to her when she was 15? Because the girl was raped. It happened to me when I was 11. So I was like, okay, it was the middle of rehearsal. I was like, and then a few days later, she came up to me and she said, look, and she held out her arm and she had a cell phone. I thought she was showing me her purple case of her iPhone. And then I realized she was showing me that she was cutting herself. And I was like, okay. So I took her outside and we had a long talk. And I said, look, make me a deal that instead of cutting yourself, you'll write, because she has real talent. And I said, and send me whatever you write. So now she's writing instead of cutting. So I just want to begin a movement. Write, don't cut. Paint, don't cut. Draw, don't cut. Whatever we do as women to hurt ourselves, we need to do the opposite. Create, you know, explore, express. Because we have learned as women particularly how to hurt, how to destroy, how to self-immolate, as opposed to going the other direction, which is making noise and having a voice and creating and getting it down and getting it out. So for me, that's how I survived and how I still survive. And I think it's a tool, and it's a really important tool. Thanks.
Yeah.
Hi there, Eve. Thank you so much for being here tonight. Earlier this evening, you said that finally it seems like something has shifted and people are finally sitting up and taking notice and welcoming what you have to say and embracing it. And I'm just wondering, you know, what do you think the, you know, is causing that shift? What, I know that there's a lot of research that's come out lately. I'm reading Half the Sky right now, and there's a lot of research that's come out that, you know, paints a tangible connection between women's economic empowerment and the well-being of their families and their children and going to school and all that. So is it, you know, because we're such a statistics-driven society, is that what you see behind that? And what can we do to, you know, make sure that that continues to progress and grow?
You know, I think there's a lot of factors. I live in V world, okay? So I see the evolution of the V-Day movement. You know, when we started 12 years ago, there was one city that did one performance. This year, there were 1,800 places on the planet that did 5,000 productions. That's change. That's change. You can't deny that all these people talking about vaginas and thinking about vaginas and, you know, articulating a movement to end violence against women isn't impacting something. Of course it isn't. Then you think about all the NGOs that have grown up over the last years and all the activists who are working, who, for example, grew out of productions or grew out of other groups who are spreading the news. And then you think about the dire situation we're in as human beings. And I think all of us know in our bodies, in our beings, in our brains, in our souls, that if we do not cherish women and protect women and girls, we're going to die as a human species. We're going to die. We know it's someplace. We know the emergency and the urgency of it in us. You know, when I'm in the Congo, where femicide, the practice, the systematic destruction of the female population is being practiced, where over 500,000 women have been raped and tortured, 6 million people have been murdered in 12 years, and it has not been in the news. But where you see the practice, the outright practice, the systematic and conscious practice of femicide, when you see that, you understand where the two possibilities we have ahead of us. Either women and vagina-friendly men are going to rise up and restore women's rightful place in the story, or we are going to destroy women and end human civilization. It's that simple. And I think we all know it, don't we? Don't we know that someplace in our being? So I think it's both the urgency and it's also many more activists. Look at how many activists are here tonight. How many people are... Look at this. I mean, it's amazing. And I go room after room after room. There are activists everywhere now fighting and standing up. So the more activists, the more power we have, we will eventually flip it. But we've just got to just spread it and get the next person to take it and the next person to take it. And then that person takes it there. And then the person who was doing it in the vagina monologues a year ago is now a head of city council. And then that person becomes a governor. And then that person becomes in the UN. And we infiltrate and we go in and we begin to change. And that's how it happens. But you have to believe that we can do it. And you have to believe that it's possible. If you told me, you know, 12 years ago that there'd be, you know, 5,000 productions in places like Islamabad and, you know, Tanzania. And I mean, the place I don't even know where the places are on the map. You know, I've never heard of countries that are doing the vagina monologues now. And it's possible. So part of it is just believing it's possible and that you have the power to transform things, you know.
In the spirit of that, I have to cut you off. Thank you very much for coming. We have no more time for questions. She will be signing books in the lobby, and I hope you will speak amongst yourselves. It feels like an anxiety dream to have the guy with the gavel cut off the righteous testimony and questionings. But hey, that's life. Smash me at your peril.
Can we thank Daniel for such an amazing, really? Woo!
There is one more question, which apparently is the question that is asked at the end of all such Commonwealth Club events, which is, what is your 60-second solution to change the world? I kind of feel like we've just had the hour-long solution to change the world, but edit it for people with short attention spans.
Yikes. Concentrated, deep, slow, loving, tender, passionate sex.
Well, good night, everyone. thank you so much for coming. Ensler will be signing books in the lobby. Doesn't it feel good to be in the know?
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you.